Thank you all for attending our FDA retailer seminar. We're going to get started. My name is Craig Cass. I'm the president of the IPCPR. And before we get started for our that's very nice up front. Thank you, Michael. Before we get started, I want to recognize our cigar sponsor. As you know, in the prior seminars, we have a manufacturer present cigars to the room. So let me bring up, I believe, Dan Genuine. Dan Genuine, Sindicato Cigars.
This is a paid political announcement brought to you by Sindicato Cigars. I knew there was a great interest in Sindicato, but I had no idea. Who would have thought? The largest attended IPCPR seminar ever, and we have the privilege of talking to you about our brand. Hello, everyone. My name is Dan Genuine, and I'm a member of the Sindicato board. My family has been in the tobacco business since 1946, and throughout those years, I have witnessed an industry that was once the pillar of strength in our nation to one that now faces the challenges that we are here to talk about today. First, let me begin by thanking the IPCPR for the opportunity to sponsor today's important seminar. Sindicato has been a proud sponsor of IPCPR seminars since our inception. Sindicato cigars are now available in over 400 retail stores. I'd like to quickly take the opportunity to tell you about the company. About 4 years ago, a group of like-minded retailers, much like yourselves, formed Sindicato Cigars to protect our business and give retailers like yourself the opportunity to purchase from a company that had the best interest of all retailers in mind. As the lines between manufacturers and retailers and consumers became more blurred, we felt it was important to start a company that would make cigars available to retailers that they could count on being, that they could count on not being discounted. If you're asking yourself the question, why would I sell Sindicato cigars? You're asking it because you are looking at Sindicato like we are your competitors. Ladies and gentlemen, you sell cigars every day just like I do, that are made by some of your biggest competitors. Just like them, Sindicato makes great cigars. The difference is that Sindicato will never sell direct to your customers, and we will never, ever compete against our customers. As I said, Sindicato cigars are now available in over 400 retail stores across the country. As the quality of our products and the understanding of our mission becomes more and more understood by retailers like yourselves, Sindicato cigars have received such ratings as one of the top 10 new cigars with a 93 rating from Cigars and Spirits magazine, our Sindicato Maduro that you're smoking today. By the way, if you didn't get one, please stop by the booth, and we'd be more than happy to give you one. We brought 450, and we may have been short. The cigar you're smoking, the Sindicato Maduro, is a Nicaraguan Puro, and I'm sure that you're going to find it to be an exceptional cigar. It may not be the best cigar you smoke this week, but I can guarantee you it'll be in the top 10. Sindicato has not just the Sindicato brand. We have offerings to satisfy all taste platforms, from our best-selling Connecticut Affinity brand to our medium-bodied Hex, our full-bodied Sindicato, and our large Maniac cigars. In addition, we're launching two new lines at the show this year. This includes a limited-release Masters Series. The Masters Series is a project that will be released annually and will showcase cigars blended by some of the most acclaimed blenders in the industry. This year, we feature a very special cigar blended by none other than Mr. Rocky Patel, made especially for Sindicato. Future Master Series editions will feature the likes of Quesada, Perdomo, Espinosa, and Padron. Our second release this year will feature an old Cuban blend that dates back to the early 1800s, a brand called Particulares. We are very excited about this brand with its old Cuban look, its feel, and its taste. The cigar was blended by master blender Arsenio Ramos and uses a Nicaraguan Corojo wrapper, a double binder, and fillers from the fields of Aganorsa. While the members of Sindicato happen to own this cigar company, we are first and foremost retailers just like yourselves. When you buy from Sindicato, you can be assured you are buying from a company that has your interest at heart. Sindicato will never sell direct to your customers. You'll never find Sindicato brands being deep discounted by online retailers. Sindicato is proud to stand with the manufacturers that understand the difficulties that retailers face when forced to compete with their suppliers. Sindicato is proud of what we stand for, and we truly hope that you will stop by our booth number 2843 over the next few days and talk with us about how we can protect your business through the sale of Sindicato brands. When you visit our booth, you won't just be talking to a manufacturer interested in selling you a cigar. You'll be talking to a fellow retailer who cares about your business. Thank you very much.
Okay, a couple of quick announcements, a couple of housekeeping items. The Cigar Bash is Wednesday night. I want to remind everyone that's a $25 ticket. Open bar, great music by Eddie Money. And if you bought a drink in Vegas, a $25 open bar for the night is pretty good. So we'd love to see you all there. Also, the PAC booth is located right outside this door. Kip, we also have another one inside on the trade show floor. It's very important. Love to have your support if you'd consider. It's voluntary, of course. $100 gets you into the early bird, which starts tomorrow morning. You get in at 9 a.m. At 2:50, we have a government affairs lounge on the floor. You have drink tickets for adult beverages. So come by. Come visit us. Finally, at the government affairs booth, we're going to get to a lot of questions today, a lot of retail-driven questions. Our panel is going to try to walk us through them. Any of the questions we don't get to will certainly be answered at the government affairs booth. Our agenda. As you see, we're going to try to cover these topics you see on the board. This has been a very, very long process. I can tell you from working on this week after week, every question brings more questions. It's a Pandora's box. There's a lot of ambiguity in the rule. Our panel is going to do their best to help give us the answers they know today. Every day, what I've learned is we have more information. We get more answers to these questions. It's a very long process. We're going to enter into compliance talks with FDA, and we're going to learn more. And as we learn more, you will know more. Let me introduce our panel. Kip Talley. Kip is our IPCPR Senior Director of Legislative Affairs. He's worked with IPCPR for a little over 3 years. He has an extensive background in politics. He's worked for Senator Arlen Specter. He's also worked for Congressman Bill Goodling, and he's worked for many different trade organizations. Kip regularly meets with high-level members of Congress and the administration to advance the message for premium cigars and pipe retailers. Kip lives in Washington, D.C. Thank you for your hard work, Kip. To Kip's right, Dave Klissold. Dave Klissold is with Hyman Phelps McNamara. He has broad-based experience advising in pharmaceuticals, biotechnology, medical device, food, and dietary supplement clients on regulatory and legislative matters. He serves IPCPR as lead FDA counsel, and he has served in this capacity for a little over 5 years. Before joining the firm in 1996, Dave conducted clinical and preclinical research at Nova Pharmaceutical Corporation and the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. I can tell you, working with Dave over the last 5 years, he's fabulous for us. He's a critical member of the team, and without Dave here today, I wouldn't have shown up. Thank you, Dave. Okay. Thanks. Barry Shavitz works with Fox Rothschild Law Firm in New York City, and he advises many cigar clients, including Altadis and the Cigar Association of America. He's a former Assistant District Attorney General for the state of New York, and Barry represents product manufacturers and industry trade associations in litigation, regulatory, and legislative matters. Barry has been a warrior for the entire cigar channel for many years, and I'm thankful that Barry's on our team. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
For those of you that were in the morning session with manufacturers, we're going to repeat some of the general information before we dive into the retail sector. So some of these slides, if you were here, you've seen before. But first of all, what we thought we would do is give everyone a little history of the Tobacco Control Act. And to set the stage, we've asked Kip to do that. Kip, if you'll walk us through.
Great. Thank you, Craig. FDA originally tried to regulate tobacco, cigarettes in 1996, but lost a legal challenge in the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2009, the president did sign the Tobacco Control Act, which moved regulation of tobacco products, specifically cigarettes, roll-your-own tobacco, and smokeless tobacco, to FDA, and created the Center for Tobacco Products. The law also said that FDA had the right to regulate any other tobacco product in the future. The Center for Tobacco Products is funded by user fees in the tobacco industry, and IPCPR has been deeply involved with different submission of comments to the Center for Tobacco Products since that law was signed in 2009. We've filed citizens' petitions, of course, the comments on the proposed rule, among other guidance documents, helping FDA understand what the premium cigar and pipe tobacco industry is all about. If you want to move forward one more slide, Craig, one of the citizens' petitions we did file in 2011 basically proposed a definition for premium cigars and requested that premium cigars be exempt from regulation because the pillar of the Tobacco Control Act was to prevent youth access and negative health effects from habitual products. We argue that premium cigars fit neither of those categories. The FDA formally responded to our 2011 citizens' petition in 2016, this year, after the rule was released, basically telling us they had addressed our concerns in the final rule, which we all in this room know not to be true. We've also been, over the past several years, through this rulemaking process, met with many high-level administration officials at the Office of Management and Budget, Small Business Administration, Domestic Policy Council, several meetings with the Center for Tobacco Products, several letters to the Center for Tobacco Products, and of course our advocacy on Capitol Hill with members of Congress and U.S. senators. The final rule, as you know, was released on May 10th of this year. FDA chose option one rather than consider the difference that premium cigars and pipe tobacco have compared to other tobacco products in the marketplace. The first of tiered enforcement will begin August 8th, and today we're going to walk through what that means for retailers and try to address some questions that have been raised as a result of this rule.
We're going to get to the compliance timeline that the FDA has published, and I'm going to kick that to Dave. Dave, if you'll walk us through the timeline.
Sure. We're going to focus on the retailer's compliance timeline, but there is some overlap with the manufacturers, so we'll probably hit the highlights of the manufacturers as well. Okay, so the big thing, the big change, August 8th, 2016, there's a prohibition on free samples. We're going to talk a little bit later about what free sample is. Manufacturers are required to register and list their products, and FDA in the final rule, somewhat surprisingly, claimed that a retailer who blends pipe tobacco is a manufacturer and thus required to register and list that product. That raises a whole host of other questions about what a manufacturing step is, so we're going to talk a little bit about that too. Minimum age requirements, can't sell to anybody under the age of 18. If you have state requirements, you'll have to pay attention to those as well. But you also have to card anybody 26 or younger. This is the extension of the rule from cigarettes and smokeless tobacco that's been around for a couple of years now to the newly deemed products, primarily cigars and pipe tobacco.
Back up.
If you are doing, if you're responsible for advertising particular brands of product, you will ultimately be responsible for complying with the labeling requirements for that advertising. And if that is you, you also have to submit a warning plan, which is basically a rotational plan. You have to rotate the certain specified warnings. The warnings have to be a certain size, certain font, black on white, all sorts of requirements. So that warning plan would have to go in May 2017. August 8th, 2018 is when the warnings themselves go into effect, and you'll have two options. You can rely on the manufacturer's warning as long as you don't change it. This was an important concession, I think, that we got into the final rule that wasn't there before, because I don't think FDA thought about that. If you also may need to have point of sale warnings, so if you're selling individual sticks and the warning can't be placed on the individual cigar, FDA has laid out a requirement that you have within 3 inches of a cash register all six of the required warnings. Next slide.
Okay, now, Barry, please talk about pre-market review and these different classifications.
Sure. Before I get on to that, let me start by making an observation about what's going on big picture. We are at the very, very beginning of a very, very long process. There is at least as much that we don't know about how this is going to work as there is that we do know. FDA is in the process of learning about cigars, learning about pipe tobacco. There's a lot that they don't know about these industries. They've learned a lot over the last 5 years. The first time we met with FDA on cigars was in April of 2011, and they knew absolutely nothing about the cigar industry, nothing. There are still a lot of questions that a lot of us have, and I know there are a lot of questions that a lot of you have. We need to have some patience, and I know it's hard because we're talking about your businesses, but a lot's going to change over the next year, the next 2 years. We're going to get answers to questions. There's litigation that's been filed. That's going to play out. There are legislative efforts going on that are going to play out. There's regulatory engagement, meetings with FDA to try and flesh out some of the unknowns, to try and get some changes made to the more onerous provisions. All of that's going to play out over the next couple of years. So with that introduction, the pre-market review process. The first item you see up there are grandfathered products. Those are products that were commercially marketed as of February 15, 2007. So if a product was commercially marketed on that date, it doesn't have to go through any pre-market review process. It can stay on the market indefinitely as long as no material changes are made to the product. It requires no pre-market review. The other three, the first two are substantial equivalents, right? That applies to products that came to the market after February 15, 2007, but before August 8, 2016. Any products that were launched between those two dates can continue to be sold, but a substantial equivalence report has to be filed with FDA. You have to get FDA permission to continue to sell the product. How do you get that? You show that the product that was launched between those two dates, the new product, is substantially equivalent to a product that was on the market before February 15, 2007. And there are a whole list of things that FDA is going to look at to compare the two. Exactly how the process is going to work for cigars and for pipe isn't clear yet. The good news is these reports aren't due for some time. They're staggered compliance deadlines. Substantial equivalence exemption is up here. FDA put that out. It is not an exemption. It applies to a company that has two products that have very, very slight differences to the additive. In the 7 years that FDA has been regulating cigarettes and smokeless tobacco, they've approved exactly one substantial equivalence exemption report, and it was for a smokeless tobacco manufacturer that wanted to make slight adjustments, very minor adjustments, to the quantities of water and salt, sodium chloride, that were in one of his products. I would not expect them to be approving very many exemption requests. Substantial equivalence, that's the longer report comparing two products. Those reports are going to be due in February of 2017. The last one on here is the pre-market tobacco application, PMTA. I don't expect cigars or pipe tobacco will submit very many, if any, of those. That applies to completely unique products, products that are unlike any that were on the market before February 15, 2007, an incredibly difficult standard to meet, and one that these industries are unlikely to attempt.
Barry, you touched on some of these periods here, but this particular slide, is there anything you need to add?
Sorry?
Is there anything you need to add here from this slide?
The timelines are pretty straightforward. The exemption requests, to the extent that anybody wants to submit them, are due next summer, 18 months, or February of 2018 is when full substantial equivalence reports are due, and August of 2018 is when any new product applications are due. Yeah, here's the compliance timeline after these reports are submitted. FDA has given itself 12 months to decide these reports, and as leverage to have proper and complete reports submitted, FDA said that if they haven't decided the report within 12 months, they reserve the right to take the product off the market. This is a result of what some of our cousins in the cigarette space were doing. They were filing SE reports on the last day that were inadequate. They were ignoring FDA requests for additional information, but FDA had no authority to remove the products. I fully expect that a company that submits a good faith substantial equivalence report by the deadline that complies with any FDA requests for additional information is not going to face enforcement. In other words, have a product taken off the market if FDA hasn't done its job. And this might be a good place to talk about FDA doing its job. One thing that is, I think, critical, FDA gets no additional money for regulating cigars and pipe tobacco than it gets right now. Right? FDA gets user fees from the tobacco industry. They get $635 million in fiscal year 17, starting October 1st. By regulating cigars and pipe tobacco, all they're doing is changing how that gets divided up among the spaces. So they're not able to do everything they need to do just regulating cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. It's completely unclear how they're going to do everything they need to do for cigars and pipe with the same amount of money.
Barry, we had a slide here on some blending changes. If you just want to make a few comments on this one.
Yeah, sure. On blend changes, FDA has taken the view that that any change to a blend, a cigar blend, a pipe tobacco blend, makes it a new product. We argued to FDA very strongly a couple of years ago that cigars, pipe, are completely different than cigarettes. They're not homogenous products. The manufacturers don't try and smooth out year-to-year differences between the blends, and in fact, in many cases, can't. So FDA accepted that argument, one of the few comments of ours that they did accept, and said that natural variations will not necessarily make a new product. So if there are weather conditions that make it impossible for a manufacturer to get the same tobacco, that won't necessarily trigger all the new product review processes. But if a manufacturer makes a change to alter the taste, the harshness, any of the other characteristics of the product, that will trigger the obligations. Exactly what constitutes a natural variation is one of the things that we're going to have to work out with FDA. They didn't define it.
Okay, let's get to a few of the good questions. You guys have submitted so many questions to the IPCPR website. We're going to get into the nuts and bolts of this now. Basically, what we've tried to do is we have a compliance committee that's working directly with the FDA, and it's really unprecedented, the three associations working together, IPCPR, CRA, and CAA. We have members of each association working together now to organize what topics, what questions do we want to take directly to FDA to get clarity. It's a very difficult process because sometimes you don't want the answer to the question, and ambiguity is a good thing. So we're working very hard on that now. Our next committee meeting is next week, and we'll start to figure some of the things out. Most of the questions we receive have fallen into these categories. And what we're going to try to do now is take some of the questions we receive through the site and ask those questions of the panel and let them give you guys some answers. The first question goes to you, Barry. It's if a manufacturer decides to not put a product through the approval process, is there a point where we have to stop selling the product as retailers, or can we continue selling the product until it runs out? Barry. Or Dave, whichever. Whoever would like to answer.
There is a point that FDA will say that sales have to stop. We don't know what that point is going to be for products that failed a substantial equivalence showing. FDA gave retailers 30 days to exhaust their stocks. It's somewhat different question when A, you're talking about cigars, and the question is if they don't submit one at all. Well, I mean, FDA isn't going to know until the very last day that a substantial equivalence report could be submitted that a manufacturer, in fact, didn't submit a substantial equivalence report. I mean, a manufacturer can say they're going to do anything, but until that day comes and goes, FDA doesn't know. So it's highly unlikely that we're going to see any sort of activity until that time frame runs out, which is 18 months from now.
Let me add to that. The last deadline for a manufacturer to file something for a product that came to market after February 15, 2007 is August of 2018. So in effect, manufacturers have a two-year window before they have to declare to FDA. If nothing is filed within that two-year window, then the product needs to be taken out of circulation. When it has to come out of your inventory isn't clear, but after 2 years, the manufacturer won't be able to put the product into market anymore unless it has filed one of these reports.
So just to be clear for retailers in the room, for this subject, the earliest this would matter is what date? Are you saying 18 months from now?
Yeah, I would actually say that for retailers in the room, the date they really need to be concerned about is 2 years out. If a manufacturer hasn't declared within 2 years,
yeah,
then there's no opportunity to get the product approved.
Okay. That's a ways out, okay? And we're going to know a lot more well before the time we get there. Okay, next question. Dave and or Barry, whoever would like to answer it.
I can't.
Will we be able to sell inventory after the rule goes into effect that does not comply with the predicate date despite having received it before the rule goes into effect?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is sort of somewhat of an open question. I mean, the predicate date is back in 2007, February 15th, 2007. Are we going to talk about the lawsuit? Because that's one of the things we're challenging in court. But again, if you were on sale on February 15th, 2007, you're exempt from all this pre-market stuff. So the manufacturer wouldn't have to submit anything. Again, the I guess the answer is sure, you can continue sell any grandfathered product, and it's up to the manufacturer to determine what the grandfathered product is.
Okay. Next question. Kip, I think this is for you. I have a private label blend in my store. Why I need to register them with the FDA, or is that up to the manufacturer or importer?
For private label blends that are in stores, I encourage you to reach out to your manufacturer and speak with them about their intentions to make filings for any smaller run product. It is up to the manufacturer or the importer to file any product that's manufactured by that company with the FDA. It's not on the retailer to do that for a private label blend. But If you do have one, I encourage you to reach out to your manufacturer and speak with them about their intent on what lines they plan to file.
We're going to work through around 20 or so of the key questions that we keep getting over and over. You also have note cards at your table. If you have a question that we might not have covered or you have a question you would like answered, fill it out and just pass it to the end of the table, and members of our board are going to come by and pick them up. Next question, Kip, again for you. We have a rewards program for customers. They receive a coupon by email. The customer can redeem the coupon and purchase anything in my store. Is this permissible?
The short answer is yes. I think this was asked in a regards to sampling, whether or not that's considered a free sample. In this case, the coupon is considered to have a cash value, so that would not be a free sample, and you would be permitted to continue that program in your shop.
Okay, thank you. I think, Barry, this was for you. If cigars are plugged, spoiled, or otherwise damaged, can I replace them for the customer, or is this considered a sample?
Yeah, no, this is an easy one. The answer is yes, these are not samples. These are replacements for defective products.
Okay, Dave, does the sampling ban apply to bulk tobacco?
That is FDA's current position.
Okay. Hi, Kip. How will the photo ID requirements affect online retailers, and when will it go into effect? Will the UPS adult signature option satisfy the requirement?
We've had direct communication with FDA on catalog phone online sales, and they have decided to leave that up to the individual company on what works for that company. So asking if the UPS adult signature option satisfies that is partially correct, but the retailer is responsible for age verification before shipping or sending any product through the mail. As we know, UPS no longer now, FedEx no longer ships tobacco. But UPS does have an age verification system in place, and FDA will do enforcement action against anybody who does not properly verify age before purchase.
Okay, Barry, a couple here in a row for you. Will it be illegal to sell tobacco products across state lines?
No.
Okay, and a follow-up, why don't e-cigarettes and vapor products have to pay user fees under the new regulation?
FDA's view is that they can only assess user fees on tobacco categories that pay federal excise tax. And right now there are six of those categories. Cigarettes, large cigars, little cigars, moist snuff, chewing tobacco, pipe, and roll your own. Thank you. That's FDA's view, that they can regulate all tobacco products, but they can only assess user fees on the six that currently pay FET. We think they're wrong. We think they've got two choices. They can regulate and assess, or not assess and not regulate. That is part of the lawsuit that's been filed.
Barry, let me interject a question that's not on the screen that came up under the manufacturer meeting this morning.
Well, that's not fair.
Yeah, well... It's the user fee explanation that you gave. I think for retailers in the room, that was very interesting, that the amount of money is there, and how is that divided with FET? And at the back of the napkin explanation, what in your opinion, is that per cigar at the end of the day for the retailers in the room?
On user fees, we mentioned before that FDA gets this year, the fiscal year starting October 1st, 2016, they get $635 million in user fees from the entire tobacco industry. That number ramps up to $712 million in fiscal year 2019. And it's divided up among all of the regulated industries, at least those that pay federal excise tax. how much the user fee is depends on what the company pays in federal excise tax. So here's sort of the back of the envelope calculation. The cigar industry, the total cigar industry, mass market, premium, everything else, paid about $640 million last year in federal excise tax. The cigar industry is probably going to pay about $70 million or so next year in user fees. You can look to see what any company, what your company paid in the federal excise tax, and that percentage of the cigar total, that percentage of $642 million, is the same percentage of the $70 million you'll pay in user fees. If you paid 1% of the federal excise taxes, or $6 million or so, if you're lucky to have business like that, you're also going to pay about 1% in user fees. So for cigars, that'll be maybe $700,000 or so. What it's going to be per cigar depends on the company. We estimate that it will likely be somewhere between 2 and 5 cents a cigar.
So it's not as big as you would think. I will give a $100 bill to anybody that can recreate that calculation. Okay, next question. Kip, I think this is for you. I do not manufacture cigars, but I do import them into the United States. Who is responsible for the user fees, the manufacturer or the importer?
The importer will be responsible for the FDA compliance because they are the one located and bringing the product into the United States for commercial sale. So that's the short answer. But in this instance, the importer would be responsible for compliance with FDA.
Okay, the next question is a great question, Kip. This is also to you. If advertising my store location or store name rather than a particular brand of cigars, are warning labels required?
This has been a really interesting question that we have thought about a lot of different ways. If you're only advertising your store name, there's no warning labels required. But if your store name or if you have a branded lounge includes the name of a cigar brand, at that point, a warning label will be required. Now, in conversation with Scott Regina from Virginia Beach, an interesting point came up. He has his shop's name is Emerson Cigars, and he has a private label brand that he has carried for 30 years at that shop called Emerson Cigar. So in that case, his store name is also a brand name and would require a warning label. I had an interesting question from a retailer who has branded vehicles advertising their cigar shop with cigar brands on those vehicles. That vehicle would be considered a rolling advertisement and require a warning label. So if you're only advertising a store name, there's no warning label required, but if that store name includes or your lounge includes a cigar brand, a warning label will be required.
Thank you. Next question, Dave, this is for you. Does the cigar warning plan include advertisements on event emails or social media postings advertising new products?
It's basically the same answer that Kip gave. If it's just advertising the name of a store, no. If it's advertising a particular brand, yes.
Okay, Kip, back to you. Must the cigar advertisement or warning labels display all six warnings at the same time?
No. The FDA has put out a timeline for retailers to submit what they're calling a cigar warning plan. There are six warnings that they have put out in this regulation. The cigar warning plan submitted to FDA will have to let them know what your plan is to rotate these warning labels on a quarterly basis so that there's equal and shared time for each one of the warnings over the course of a year and a half. So that is far out. That's something that isn't going into effect for 2 years, and something we'll continue to engage with FDA on to receive clarity and some guidance. But all six labels will not be required to be displayed at the same time on advertisements, though, as Barry mentioned, or Dave mentioned, the warning sign next to the cash register will be required to show all six warnings for sale of single cigars. And IPCPR will be working with FDA to develop those warnings for retailers and allow us to give you some guidance to make sure it's the correct font and the right lettering and things like that.
Okay. Barry, for you. Should I be worrying, this is an easy one, should I be worrying about warning labels on my cigar boxes, or are there other pressing issues that need my attention?
Yeah, this was a question more for the manufacturers, and I think you can tell by the way it was worded what the answer is. The warning requirements don't kick in for almost 2 years, May of 2018. A lot's going to happen between now and then. The size of the warnings is part of the litigation that's been filed. There are a number of things that are going to happen. Warnings are something to be mindful of, but there are other things that people need to be paying attention to between now and then.
Okay, Barry, also for you, if the cigars are in a display case but not in the boxes with warning labels, is this a violation?
No, single cigar sales are still permitted, and single cigars and cellophane don't have to have the warnings on them. As long as the retailer has the point of sale warnings that have been discussed already, that's fine.
Okay, Dave. Will branded promotional store items such as ashtrays, shirts, hats, cutters, etc., be required to display warning labels?
Here's the not so short answer. Let me start by saying branded items for cigarettes and smokeless tobacco are prohibited. It's not clear yet whether FDA is going to prohibit or allow them for cigars and other newly regulated products. I expect that if FDA allows them, then the warning requirements will apply. Lastly, some of the cigar manufacturers signed a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission 16 years ago, and that agreement requires health warnings on the branded items sold by those companies. So if FDA allows branded items for cigars and pipe, I think it's reasonable to assume that they are going to require the health warnings.
All right, Kip. Can we provide cigars to golf courses for their tournaments where cigars are included in the tournament package?
In my interpretation, if you're making a charitable donation, there's a cash value assigned to that donation. I would make sure that you receive credit for that donation. And I think this question was kind of around asking if that's considered a sample. If it's clear that the cost of admission to that event includes cigar in the cost of their participation, then I think that would not be considered a free sample, and you would continue to be able to do that.
All right, so a little more direct on charity. Dave, this is to you. Can we donate cigars to a charitable auction or charity event?
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, just kind of following up what Kip said, if there's a value that can be attached to that product, it is not a free sample. So if you're taking a deduction on that contribution, then it has value. There's another school of thought which says, you know, buy them, pay a dollar for them, and now they're not coming from a retailer, they're coming from a citizen. I mean, as far as I know, adults are permitted to do whatever they want to with their own cigars. So We haven't specifically asked FDA that question, but it just stands to reason that the restriction applies to retailers and manufacturers, and it strikes me that when you're making a charitable contribution, you can be doing that on behalf of your business, but you can also be doing it on behalf of yourself.
And I would just add on charitable events, the rule doesn't allow a manufacturer to provide free samples to retailers either. So if you do some type of annual charitable event, like a big smoke kind of thing, those cigars will have to be paid for by the retailer in order to have them displayed at the event.
Okay, let's get into pipe tobacco. I know if I've been stopped 20 times today, 19 have been about pipe tobacco. So Barry, this is for you. If FDA considers each pipe a tobacco product as a component or part, will each individual pipe be required to go through an approval process?
As absurd as it sounds, that appears to be FDA's current position. It's one of the things that we're going to have to discuss with them. It's part of the litigation that was filed. But the way FDA outlined their view of a pipe in the final rule, the answer is yes. They're going to want each new pipe to go through the SE process.
Let's keep it going. Kip, if I import pipes from Europe, who is responsible for the FDA approval process, myself or the manufacturer?
In my interpretation, the person responsible is the importer, much like the previous question I took. But as Barry said, I think there's a lot of conversations that need to be had with FDA about pipe tobacco. They did not, part of the regulation, they did not take into account how many people sell pipe tobacco, how many people sell pipes. They put into the rule that they didn't have an estimate on how many retailers or how many manufacturers could be affected by what they've put through the rule on pipe tobacco. They never came to us and asked how many retailers we had sold pipe tobacco. They put estimates in about how many people, how many businesses sell e-cigarettes, so they were able to do their research there, but apparently not with the pipe tobacco category. So, as Barry mentioned, I think there's going to be a number of conversations on this subject with the FDA.
Okay, Dave, this is for you. I understand blending is out. Are we still able to sell tobacco by the ounce without being considered a manufacturer?
This is still an open question with FDA. It's one we're trying to get clarity on. I analogize it to the same situation as taking an individual cigar out of a box of cigars, and FDA has said that's okay. So I have not heard FDA say that about pipe tobacco, but it is one of the questions we plan on getting in front of them very quickly. It's also sort of part of the lawsuit.
You know, I think we should stay on this topic for just a second, because there are many, many people in this room where it's a critical piece of their livelihood. We have gotten direct answers from FDA that we can't do this, but if we look at the intent of, as you said, buying cigars in 25s, and I was actually on a legal call with some of these guys where they were disagreeing on this. So, Dave, what does it mean? Help the retailers or Barry understand when you say we're not sure, we're going to figure it out. Through compliance, we're going to interact directly with FDA. Maybe talk a little about that process and why you think we can get clarity on this topic.
You want to start, Ben?
Yeah, Barry or Dave.
Let me start it this way. When the final rule came out, there was a meeting of the three cigar trade associations in Washington, and we mapped out a strategy that a number of you know about that proceeded on two tracks. One was a compliance track. What do we need to do for the industry, and this includes pipe also, to figure out how to comply with the final rule? The other track is what we would call a changes track. What do we need to do to try and get changes made to the final rule to get relief from some of the more onerous provisions? This changes track includes the litigation that we filed. It includes the legislative effort that's going on in Washington, and it includes regulatory engagement, meetings with FDA to talk about some of the unanswered questions, right? Some of the provisions that are particularly problematic. Again, there are so many things that FDA doesn't know about the cigar industry, about the pipe tobacco industry. Some of the things that they are requiring make no sense from a practical perspective. So I think there's going to be an opportunity to shape how they implement the final rule, even if we don't get changes made to its actual language.
And in my mind on that particular question, Craig, I think there's a key distinction between somebody, a customer coming in and asking for a quantity of pipe tobacco and you putting it in a bag for them to go. I think there's a clear distinction between that and pre-packaging something in 2-ounce bags that's sitting on your shelf, which somebody can walk up and grab one of the bags to pay for. I think the latter is what FDA considers manufacturing, which is defined through the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and includes within the definition anyone who repackages a tobacco product. I think the first scenario of somebody on demand asking for a certain quantity of pipe tobacco in your store is much like, as Craig mentioned, somebody asking for a particular cigar out of a box and you putting it in a Ziploc for them to go.
Okay, next question. Dave, this is for you. Even if we do not blend tobacco and do not register as a manufacturer, so we're not blending and we're not registered as a manufacturer, we're a retailer, do we need to put warning labels on that 2-ounce bag of tobacco? And if we do, when do we need to start doing it?
Just to follow up on something Kip said, yeah, I think there is a difference when you have products sitting on a shelf that a consumer can walk in and grab versus putting it into a bag. So I think the FDA has a better argument when it's sitting on the shelf devoid from any other warning connected to that pipe tobacco. This is, again, something that FDA hasn't really explained yet. If there is a warning requirement, again, this would be 2 years out.
Okay, next question, Barry, again on pipe tobacco and pipes. We have dozens of pipes on our shelves, some that have been displayed on sale for several years. Will each of these pipes need to be sold before a certain date since they have not been through an approval process? So it sounds like old inventory.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think what will happen if nothing gets changed is that by the end of that 2-year window that we talked about earlier, if nothing's been filed by a manufacturer, then the product won't be able to be sold anymore unless, again, it's a product, a pipe that was on the market before February 15, 2007. In that case, it's a grandfathered product, and it doesn't have to go through any pre-market review process.
Okay, they've selected some questions here. We've had a lot of questions come in, and let me reiterate one point. All the questions are going to be lumped by category. We're going to answer all the questions, and they're going to be posted on the ipcprlegislative.org site. So as well as this presentation, the stuff these guys have talked about will be posted as well. But we've picked a few questions here that maybe we didn't cover today. So on the cigar side, can retailers build their own sample packs until a certain date or after a certain date? And really anybody, Dave, Barry?
My interpretation of the rule is that repackaging cigars into a sampler pack and putting that on a shelf, making it available for commercial sale, would, in FDA's eyes, deem you to be a manufacturer, which is absurd. But
which is very absurd.
Yeah.
So to explain that further, I want to make sure people understand. So if someone walks in your humidor and buys 3 cigars, you can sell those 3 individual cigars and put them in a bag versus taking those 3 cigars, putting them in a bag, and have them at the register as your July sampler, correct?
That is my interpretation, and I think that's what FDA would say as well.
But again, I mean, so you would have to physically take each one of those cigars, put it into a bag, and have those, let's say, five particular cigars available in a bag. So could you have a list of 20 cigars, and the consumer gets to pick out five of whatever is on that list of 20, put them in their own bag? We think that's not manufacturing.
All right, just to make sure we're talking about the timetable for the people in the room, when does that start to matter? For instance, if we're doing sample bags today, at what date should we quit that process?
Well, on August 8th, 2016, FDA would believe that was a manufacturing process, and you are a manufacturer, and you have until December 31st of the year to register. What you do between August and December, I don't think FDA has any control over.
Yeah, to be clear, after August 8th, any new sample packs that weren't on the market before August 8th are going to be considered new products. If you've been creating the sample pack before August 8th, you can continue to create the same one after August 8th. You just can't create new ones. That's FDA's view of all of this. It is part of the litigation. That's part of the absurdity of some of what FDA is doing.
Hi, here's an interesting question. If and when Cuban cigars become available, do they have to comply?
There's no way to answer that now. That's an impossible question to answer right now.
I know.
And I don't think there's any appetite in the U.S. Congress to lift any section of the embargo until Cuba embraces political freedom and democracy.
All right, here's a pretty good legal question. Is the retailer's liability tied to the manufacturer's failure to comply with the FDA guidelines?
Dave?
Well, it could make the product deemed adulterated or misbranded. We didn't go into a lot of detail about that, but really all that means is that FDA can take action against the product, and it can take action against the manufacturer. Now, taking action against a product can include seizure. So the retailer can't be cited for a manufacturer's noncompliance, but you can lose product.
Last one here, Paul. We want to spend a few minutes on our industry legal challenge. We wanted to give everybody an update on what happens next with our complaint. The FDA is making it illegal to hand out samples. Does that include the shop owner? Anybody?
Yes, is the answer. Yeah, sampling. Yes. But anything that's tied to a transaction is not free sampling. So there's a difference between handing a customer a cigar to try after he's just purchased a box and handing a customer a free cigar when he first walks into your store. Anything that is transaction related is not a free sample. Anything that is not transaction related is likely going to be considered a free sample.
So if there is, for instance, a buy five, get one free, that is permissible and not considered a free sample.
We've got some comedians in the room. On one of these cards, I have written, or someone has written, knowing the font sizes and the standard warning labels FDA has presented, what size warning label would Rocky Patel need to put on his body? This is serious. You guys are not taking this serious. Okay, we wanted to update the room on really the unprecedented coalition for the legal challenge. It took a while. You know, we needed patience, and we needed to file a complaint that we felt like was solid. And so what I'd love to do is really walk through here. See, on July 13th, IPCPR, CAA, and CRA, we filed a complaint.
Actually, the 15th, sorry.
What was it?
That was my fault. July 15th.
July 15th, okay. So you can see here what we tried to do. The lawsuit was filed in the United States District Court, District of Columbia, in D.C. So what we want to do is, Barry, you walk us through. These are basically the nuts and bolts of our complaint and why we think they're important. But try to give everybody a little understanding of what we're doing.
Yeah, just a few words on the lawsuit. It was filed on Friday, February 15th in court. There are 9 separate counts or causes of action. And the complaint really challenges all of the primary provisions of the final rule. It challenges the February 15, 2007 predicate date, which forces the cigar industry, the pipe tobacco industry, to look back 9 years to find grandfathered products, when cigarettes and smokeless tobacco, which have been regulated since 2009, only have to look back 2 years. It challenges FDA's decision to use the same substantial equivalence process for cigars and pipe tobacco as it is using for cigarettes and smokeless tobacco. It challenges the user fee provisions on a number of counts. First, it alleges that user fees in this case are really a tax. Every other agency in the federal government that assesses user fees on regulated companies gives those companies some benefit. In the pharmaceutical industry, user fees are assessed when a drug company wants to bring a new drug to market, right? It applies to FDA, says we want to bring this new product to market. FDA does all the testing, assesses a user fee because it has to do all of that work. In our case, we're simply paying for the benefit of being regulated, and I question what the real benefit is to this industry. We also challenge the user fees on the grounds that they're regulating industries that aren't assessing user fees, e-cigarettes in particular. The lawsuit challenges the health warnings, the changes to the health warnings that are being used by some companies now, and also the size, 30% on packages, 20% on advertising. Challenges FDA's rejection of option 2, as it was called, the exemption for premium cigars, on the grounds that FDA had some obligation to examine the option 2 proposal, which it didn't do. It made absolutely no effort to do a cost-benefit analysis to see if the regulations being imposed on the premium industry are justified. It challenges the decision by FDA to treat retailers who blend different types of pipe tobacco into their own blend as manufacturers. It challenges FDA's decision to treat pipes as regulated tobacco products rather than accessories, which are not regulated. And it challenges FDA's apparent decision to treat retailers who create their own sample packs as manufacturers as well. So it goes after all of the major provisions of the final rule. It was filed a couple of weeks ago. We'll get some schedule over the next few weeks or a month. Whoever loses is guaranteed to appeal. So the lawsuit is going to take some time to play out.
Thank you.
I will mention on the lawsuit that we were assigned a judge to the case, and a lot of the judges in the district court in D.C. are career federal employees, career federal prosecutors. This particular judge was not. He came from a private firm, which is a positive thing for us. He has ruled against the government in other cases that we've looked at. He is not likely, in my opinion, to consolidate our case with any of the other e-cigarette cases that have been filed in the district court. So I think our IPCPR's attorney working on this is pleased with the selection, and hopefully we'll continue to move the case forward and provide you with updates as we get them.
I was advised, I skipped over this slide, had trigger finger, but just a disclaimer of legal liability. The materials contained in this presentation are the opinions of our professionals and should not be relied upon as legal advice for your company. One thing I want to say is many of the retailers, we weren't hit very hard. Most of the requirements for FDA fall on the manufacturers. And most of these things kick in for us, as you've heard, in 12 to 18 months. Business is very good. We're going to continue selling our products. For this show, I said it earlier, it's business as usual. You know, on the cigar side, with 4 to 6 turns a year, buy your products, sell your products. Business is going to be going. The compliance period, we have time to interact with FDA. We have our legal challenge. We're going to transition and talk about the legislative strategy and what we're doing at the federal level for legislation. That's next. We roll right into it. But there are many, when you're sitting in your store and you feel like, wow, the sky's falling, all the press is bad, social media, it's terrible. But many, many people are working very hard to get clarity for everyone in the room. It's happening daily. I know myself, I'm spending 10 hours a week on this stuff as a volunteer. But we're all very active, the three associations, CAA, CRA, and IPCPR. Many, many resources are being spent. Your membership is critical. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being a member of the association. Your fellow retailers in your state, encourage them to join the association. A lot of dollars are being spent, and I am cautiously optimistic. I feel very good interacting with guys like we have here working for us. You know, it's like if we're a team in the NFL, the rules change year over year. You find the good teams adapt, and they win year over year. We're going to adapt. We're going to play by the new rules, and we're going to be successful. We're going to be in business. My good friend Barry Chavis has a quote that I absolutely love. We'll be selling cigars a year from now, 3 years from now, 10 years from now. The rules will change, but we'll be in the game. What I'd like to do now before we transition to the legislative strategy and update you on some state strategy stuff is have Scott or John, whoever wants to come up and introduce our next cigar sponsor. We're going to have a stay where you are. We're going to have another cigar coming out. And if I could have someone come up and introduce the next sponsor, we're going to transition and let you know what are we doing on the legislative side with the appropriations and legislative vehicles.